In the past, I've spoken about how important I believe the splits are in our lives and in our energy fields. And by that I mean these times when we were involved in energy exchange experiences that proved to be too shocking, too overwhelming, too dominating, and it's kind of like being hit by lightning. Who we thought we were got broken, shattered, fragmented, or split into something other than the way we started that scenario. So today's talk is really based upon these couple of different ideas of how much of us do we hide? How many of our, quote, sins, unquote, do we hide from others and even ourselves? And for that reason, today's talk is called Fraud, Guilt, Regret, and Remorse. In Scientology, a hidden action is called a withhold. Withholding from others and even ourselves burdens us. It's easy for me to imagine withholds as weighty clouds of energy slowly but steadily pressing down on us and thereby interfering with the easy functioning of our hearts and minds, our muscles and bones, organs, tissues, and cells in our bodies. In Christ Returns, reveal startling truth. Christ emphasizes the need for remorse for our actions that have hurt others. I think that remorse may be an alternative reaping of the seeds that we have sown that have resulted in pain and discomfort for others. In my talks about human needs, I refer to SFULI plus 2. That stands for the human needs of survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, and the need to look good, / get approval. All these needs can coalesce into creating a facade that we think will help us get our needs met. We try to project the image of a good person, a hard-working person, intelligent, strong, successful person. In other words, a loving person worthy of being loved by all others. When I started the exploration of this topic, fraud, guilt, regret, and remorse, it was because I thought that by admitting, confessing, confronting my own behaviors that I considered dark, bad, harmful, dishonest, that I could release some of the major stops that keep me from expressing myself and my uppercase S self more fully. This process is self-serving, but if it proves valuable to me, I would kind of generalize it to being valuable to other people with similar struggles. We are born to express. It seems that expression is our means of creating. While divine consciousness supports our growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing and repair, protection, fulfillment of need, our work, the survival through rhythm, and the predictable law of cause and effect, all these flows are to allow and enable us to express our talents, passions, our intelligences, and overall, our consciousness. An oak tree growing tall would have no purpose if it didn't provide shade, branches for birds and chipmunks to build nests in, acorns for squirrels, sustenance, and for the next generation of oak trees. Growth for the sake of growth makes no sense to me. Expression for the increase of well-being makes complete sense. While the expressions available to oak trees and rose bushes and tomato plants are confined to certain patterns, our expressions as humans are virtually unlimited. It is in the area of expressions, our behaviors, that are the physical creative energies that define our lives. These behaviors are informed or misinformed by our consciousness, egoic human consciousness, or by our access to a higher level consciousness. In an ideal situation, our families would have demonstrated and taught us values that are more harmonious with others and with ourselves. Harmony is health. It is love because harmony doesn't battle for superiority. Pretending to be good while the truth is the opposite is fraud. Pretending to be thoughtful of others when the thoughts are really about the self is fraud. Looking back at past behaviors to see them for what they were could be the first step toward release and freedom and redemption. If I can identify what I did that hurt others, and of which I tried not to see the truth, I can take responsibility for my actions. Without making excuses or creating justifications for my very human behaviors, Christ says that we have to explore all avenues that seem to be the paths to happiness in order to discover they are not the path to happiness. Exhausting all other possibilities, we can then align ourselves with Christ's way. Until we make innumerable mistakes, we will naturally seek easier, more comfortable, more convenient, and more gratifying ways of being happy. And I have made innumerable mistakes. Making mistakes, almost always due to the lack of awareness, is natural and normal. Learning from mistakes is what is supposed to happen. That leads to an elevation of awareness. Not learning from mistakes leaves us saddled with guilt and regret. And if we're normal, it'll be guilt and regret. And if we're not, it'll be indifference. It is the weight of the unlearned from mistakes that seem to be what keeps us split and lingering in guilt and regret. How to translate these mistakes to learning energies may hold the key to healing and happiness. Years ago in a regression session, I had the sense that I impulsively wanted to be born in order to overcome the mistakes that led to my death. I wonder if my impulsivity resulted in my mother, who was already overwhelmed with a husband and four children, to become pregnant. Was this an example of my wanting overriding all other considerations, including the impact of my birth upon my mother, my father, and my siblings? Is this my normal and natural mistake? My wanting takes priority over all others. Making myself the priority sure sounds like my ego at work, doesn't it? My parents told me I didn't talk until I was about 3 years old. My father joked that I got everything I wanted without talking, so what was the point of talking? However, not talking can also be an indication of withholding. If my regression experiences were valid, maybe guilt was holding me back. I do know now that my personality type needs and wants a lot of certainty. Newborns are a lot more conscious than we give them credit for. In other forms of regression, and even during this lifetime, I experience very negative consequences from my communication. Maybe as an infant, I needed to understand how communication worked in my family before I would feel safe enough to open up. Yes, I admit it. I want what I want when I want it. That's not a problem in and of itself. It is a problem how that impacts other people, that makes it a problem or not. As a little boy, I found a box turtle in the woods. I brought it home. I kept it in a shoebox without a lid on top. I don't know if I wanted to care for something or if I wanted to possess something. We had two dogs, so I made sure to elevate the turtle and its box. One day I put it on top of the burning barrel, which is a 55-gallon barrel in the backyard that we use to burn trash. My sister Patty took out the trash, set it on fire, and put the lid back on along with my turtle and its box. I felt the most awful anguish when I found out that my turtle had been burned to death. My feelings exceeded the level of normal pain. Something other than the death of a turtle must have been triggered in me. To jump ahead. As a young teenager, I read the book, The Agony and the Ecstasy, about the Renaissance. The lives of Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo convinced me that to be great, you had to suffer. Suffering led to greatness. That is not the best belief to have. However, in that book, the individual who I most resonated with was Girolamo Savonarola, a monk who challenged the Medicis and the Roman Catholic Church for being corrupt. Ultimately, Savonarola was tortured and burned to death at the stake for heresy. Back to my turtle. I felt that my wanting it killed it. If my intention was to care for it, I failed terribly. Soon after, I captured a small mouse in our home. I kept it in a shoebox with a lid on it, fed it. It died a couple of days later. I never knew if it died on its own or if it had been killed. My mother was not thrilled with a pest being kept as a pet. I did decide that I wasn't able to care for living things, and if I tried, emotional pain and their deaths would follow. I never wanted a pet from that time on. The idea of populating a timeline with events of fraud, guilt, regret, and then remorse seems to be important. Communication is important to me. It's an area of sensitivity, perhaps due to regret. Here's the story. At 6 years old, I was watching a parade from a second floor office window. I was with my father and three older sisters. As a red fire truck went by, I described it as a green fire truck. They all burst out laughing at my mistake, and I was mortified and humiliated. It was an awful feeling. I regretted and regret still using the wrong word and being laughed at. Words were and are important to me. They were to my mother and father, too. My mother shared vocabulary-building books with me. As a going-away-to-college gift, she gave me a Roget's Thesaurus, which I cherished and still have on my bookshelf. My late wife, Marianne, would say, "My personality type is where my perfectionist, mistake-averse attitude comes from." Perhaps. In another past life regression, a life as an Irish monk transcribing holy books was found. You can imagine that someone copying texts like the Book of Kells would be in trouble if they made mistakes. There was no whiteout, no backspacing, no editing. It had to be perfect the first time. If these regressions are accurate, the existence of the fears saying the wrong thing, writing the wrong thing, are understandable. The persistence of those fears in this lifetime is not. In the 1990s, when I lived in San Diego, I had a phone conversation with my brother George in New York. He spoke about ending a long-term relationship and said, more than anything, he hates regret. He hates to feel responsible for causing someone else's pain. I told him it was the same for me. Regret is a really, really bad feeling. Everything we do in life affects someone. Maybe ourselves, others, pets, even inanimate objects like furniture, cars, physical property. The ego works through the personality, striving to satisfy its foreign driving needs. Maybe we could say that our personality is our public-facing identity that we shape and use to get our needs fulfilled. Little girls tend to have sweeter personalities than little boys. Perhaps they are already aware of the adage, "You can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar." Besides flies, honey appeals to people more than vinegar. There's a sales rule that says people want to buy from people they know, like, and trust. If people want to fulfill our needs and want to because they like us and want to make us feel good, energy acquisition for us is easier. Attention, approval, and rewards come more often. I was 5 years old in kindergarten. A friend had a pair of cool cowboy gloves. I asked my mother to buy a pair of these gloves for me. She said no. The next day or so, I stole that friend's gloves by taking them out of his jacket and putting them into the sleeve of my jacket. When he reported the loss, the teacher went through all the coat pockets looking for them. She didn't check the sleeves. Even then, I wondered how I knew to hide the stolen goods in my sleeve. That seemed to be too mature and worldly for a 5-year-old boy. I had to have been accessing some other level of awareness. At some time in my life, a psychic told me I had the potential to be ruthless. I felt bad about stealing those gloves ever since. Now I wonder if my needs were being fulfilled by suffering the guilt and regret before I even got home with the gloves. I realized I had violated important family value of honesty as I'm walking back home. When I sadly got home, I hid the gloves deep away in a closet and never wore them. Having learned the pain of that experience brought up a pattern. Getting what I want will cause me pain and pain for others as well. I wanted a turtle. It was burned to death. I wanted a mouse. It died. I wanted the gloves. I got them, felt terrible about what I did, and deprived the rightful owner of the enjoyment. And I could never even wear the gloves because they were so distinctive. Recently, I was driving my car in Naples, and I noticed the way a couple of other drivers were driving. They weren't driving the way I do, and I wasn't driving the way they do. It dawned on me that I didn't have to make up stories based upon my judgments. I didn't need to invest in creating a reality for myself about their driving. I didn't have to project my thoughts or judgments onto them. That line of thinking took me to the idea that we create swirling energies around anything we judge, kind of like a tornado. Putting swirling energies around us, our own environment, doesn't serve us any more than causing a tornado or invoking hurricanes to come to us. Maybe our judgments are attempts to make us more as they make others less. Maybe the basis of frauds, guilt, regret, is connected to attempts to be more, to be enough. It's easy to see my fraudulent attempts to appear more cause me pain when they failed. I now think my turtle and mouse experiences were innocent attempts to be more by having more possessions and possibly by having more things to love. When we are afraid to reveal the true self as we understand it, whatever age we happen to be and whatever that means to us, we necessarily have to create a facade, a shield, boundaries, walls, etc., to protect our individuality. Our ego insists on this self-protective process. It is normal, and it is right. In our culture, money is connected to feelings of being enough or not enough. This subject is tricky, though. The fact that a person has money does not mean that person feels they are enough. Just because a person doesn't have money doesn't mean they feel they're not enough. Our relationship with money starts very early in life. Prior to our conceptions, our parents could be worried about whether they can afford another child, or this one, if it's the first. During pregnancy, during birth, and after, there can be significant financial burdens. We will absorb the energy of our parents' thoughts, feelings, words, and actions on the subject of finances. My parents couldn't afford me, their fifth child. They knew it, especially my mother. On some level, I knew that I was a financial problem for my family. If you parse that sentence down to two words, you have financial problem. I have a brother, John, who is 2 years older than me. After our three older sisters were born, along came John. My father's holodynes, which is a concept from the book Holodynamics, of father-son relationships got activated. I am told that my grandfather was tough and unforgiving, and his harsh treatment of his son, my father, proved that point. I never met my grandfather, but I have been told that he believed that to succeed in life, you had to be tough, with toughness being the top priority, perhaps followed by education. He brutalized my father. When John and I collaborated to take change off my father's nightstand, out of his pockets, of his suits, and out of his car glove compartment, John said, "If you get caught, nothing will happen to you, but if I get caught, I'll get punished." So John was my Fagin, and I was his Oliver Twist. More withholds about stealing money stacked up on my consciousness. Maybe this entire talk could be how my personality expressed my ego. This shouldn't be justification for my behaviors, but a framework for looking at my behaviors. They were either ego-driven, or they were impelled by a higher part of me, perhaps the real me. I wanted to come in first in the race of life. I was not fleet of foot, so I wasn't going to win a foot race. I was too clever, though, and that allowed me to cheat at a game we played in the sixth grade. It was like bingo, and I cheated in order to win. Thinking about it now reminds me of a loss in that grade. We had to guess the number of jelly beans in a jar in order to win it. Before the reveal, I told a friend to take my chosen number, and I would take another number. The number I gave away was the exact number, so my friend won the jelly beans. When I got home, my mother asked me, "Where are your jelly beans?" My teacher had told her the day before that I had the exact number in my guess. I pushed away winning fairly, perhaps as an indication of the work of the law of cause and effect. I took what wasn't mine, and I lost what was mine. That's fair. I like it. In some families, adult acquaintances are referred to aunt and uncle. Not in my family. My parents didn't socialize at home. They referred to everyone by their first name, so I did too. When I was 11, playing baseball in the summer at a school in an organized morning of kids' activities, I was playing shortstop. A history teacher, baseball coach, was pitching. I was a dedicated baseball fan and player. I knew that talking it up during the game was valued by one's team and managers. So there I was, chanting, using the coach's nickname, which is the only name I had ever heard him called. "Come on, dude! Strike him out! Come on, dude!" After some unknown amount of time, dude ran over to me screaming, and the only thing I remember standing there in shock was him screaming, "Who do you think you are?" repeatedly. I was stunned and shocked into silence. Was I trying to impress him with my pep talk? Probably. Did I feel pride in knowing this fine point of playing baseball? Definitely. Could dude have told me to call him coach? Of course. As I learned over the years, he was not always in control of his emotions, and that day was an example. But after that day, I never trusted him again. Over the years and in high school, I would have serious confrontations with him, repeatedly. It may have been that night that I got sick and delirious, so much so that it frightened my brother John, who went and got my father to come up and help, try to calm me down. Years later, a famous psychic in a reading asked me what happened to me between the ages of 8 and 10. He went on to say that something happened that split me in two. I was a winner, and in that event, I was split into a winner and a loser. I wonder if that was the event. In my neighborhood was an older woman who paid me, or another kid, my age, of about 10, to ride to the grocery store and buy things for her. When we returned with the groceries, she would pay us 25 cents. One day, filled with pride and joy upon returning, I said, "And I didn't even need to look at the list." And she said, "And that is the reason you didn't get everything on the list." That took the wind out of my sails. I pleaded with her to let me go back and get the missing item, but she adamantly refused. That was my last time she asked me to do this chore. Is this an example of trying to acquire energy? Look at me, look at me, see what I did. I am sure it was. Was it an example of me overestimating my capabilities? Yes, it was. And this event didn't stop that pattern from recurring. It was in the same aforementioned sixth grade that I was aware that I was totally, completely, and frighteningly in love with Marianne Slojewski. In the seventh grade, one lunchtime, leaning against the gym door watching other kids playing, the door was slammed and it crushed the tip of my left index finger off. Bleeding like crazy, the school nurse took me to the doctor. Some weeks later, fussing about the finger, which was an attempt to get attention, my homeroom teacher, Mrs. Hamp, looked at it and scoffed. "The way you talked about it, I thought you lost half your finger." I was humiliated. I was babying myself. She was a hard, uncompassionate woman. In her defense, her one son was born with half an arm and one complete arm. She didn't baby him. Despite success in sports and school, he had a terrible later life and death that I attribute to the lack of compassion that he learned from his mother. Another story that money... about money that goes back earlier. Maybe I was 11 years old when John and I went to a neighboring store, Marshall's. We bought something, and as we left, John realized they had given us the wrong change. They had given us a $20 bill instead of a single dollar bill. I wanted to return to the store and give the money back, but John refused. We immediately went to the Army-Navy store and spent the money. I bought a 10-inch jackknife with a plastic handle that looked like the mother of pearl. It was not designed for throwing, but I threw it into the ground, and the blade broke immediately. I had the money for 10 minutes and got rid of it. I had the knife for 5 minutes, and I broke it. My father saw the knife, took it away, and asked where I got the money. I lied. I had it. End of conversation. Throughout high school, I was told by a couple of coaches and teachers that I had a bad attitude. I certainly did have an attitude. Bad is usually the label applied when you don't obey or fulfill others' expectations. I didn't trust myself, I didn't trust my teachers, and I didn't trust most adults. I do regret my defensiveness. It prevented me from learning more. Trying to always be right is a symptom of feeling wrong. Being right doesn't solve the problem of feeling wrong. Healing the feeling of being wrong solves the problem. I wasn't a good student. I wasn't invested in learning. I was invested in an attitude that provided a field of safety around me. The bad boy attitude in high school can be misinterpreted by immature others as confidence. Defiance isn't necessarily confidence, as it's more likely it's a rejection of other people's viewpoints out of defensiveness. All these years later, I see attitude as the option chosen by those of us who don't believe they can be sufficiently productive. Attitude or productivity. A variation on this theme occurred with me over the years, trying to create the impression that I was working hard as a way to obfuscate a lack of production. As I mentioned, the creation of an attitude betrays self-doubt. In order to look good, get approval, but not actually doing anything productive, I got an attitude. In theory, this aloof, defiant attitude would be an effective substitute for accomplishment, but it isn't. Like a fire started with a crumpled piece of newspaper, the good feelings from copying an attitude are short-lived and don't generate much light or warmth. This attitude, driven by fear, insecurity, self-consciousness, and defensiveness, may be the main fraud I perpetrated. For my entire life, I've avoided feelings of vulnerability, wrongfully believing these feelings were signposts on the path to pain, failure, and disappointment. That view changed, though, reading a book given to me by my daughter-in-law, Ashley, shortly after my wife, Marianne, died. The author, Brené Brown, encourage the following. When you feel vulnerable, lean into it. Don't back away and retreat. I wished I had this idea while Marianne was alive. I saw how many of my actions were vulnerability backing away. That tendency added a burden to Marianne because sometimes I insisted on doing things the hard way because the other way made me feel invulnerable. As I said, admitting wrongdoing could be an essential step in healing the splits that plague our lives and add to our suffering. Christ would add, as he did in Christ Returns, reveals startling truth that remorse is also required. Remorse is the act and acceptance of feeling what my action caused to others. To me, it seems like a satisfaction of the law of cause and effect. It is a reaping of sorts, as I said earlier. Most of my talk has been fueled by me thinking about healing me and as a way to demonstrate a means to self-healing. It is mostly self-absorbed, with a hope that I can heal the energies that have led me to focus so much on myself, so that brotherly love and balancing the self-interest of others and ultimately unconditional love can be the norms in my life. I want to heal is self-focus. I want to heal to fulfill a divine purpose through expressing the divine is how I want to think and feel. Hiding behind a fraudulent facade to avoid criticism, emotional or physical attack may be okay with my ego, but it's not okay with my higher spiritual inspirations. The safety, love, success, and health and happiness that my ego demands are already available to me and you. All I and you have to do is open and be honest to receive these energies. One line in the prayer that I'm about to recite says that Father Mother Life is perfectly receptive of us because it is universal loving intelligence. The real us is inside. The ego is like a suit of armor weaponized to get our needs met. The real us can become aware that Father, Mother, Life can and will meet all of our needs perfectly for us. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Hear how it can help us let go of fraud, guilt, regret, and allow us healing remorse. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.